All right, our first story this morning is from our own Alex Cohen, and he's going to tell stories about the Darlington.
Hope everybody enjoyed breakfast. There's plenty more lox and snacks and everything. We got lots of food here. Please eat it. There are even boiled peanuts in the back. I'm sure that if Joel knew I'd pull the boiled peanuts back out to serve people, he'd really have fun with that. Okay. Darlington. 1785. It's an old community. So it was here, as I said in my presentation yesterday, before Florence. And, you know, you were back in the days, you traveled by the rivers or traveled by horseback. These were more like land grants from the king. And the community of Darlington was established because basically, I forget the two places. One was Sherall and it was somewhere else. The two people rode, and when they met halfway, that's where the courthouse will be here, and that's where they built Darlington. So it's been around for a long time. Well, there have been Jews in Darlington for a good while, and as the ISJL piece and the thing said, you know, in 1845, and even the story I wrote, but in doing a little more research, first known Jewish resident of Darlington, I found out, was somewhere around 1815. He was Robert Lazarus. He was a tanner from London, England. I couldn't find out any more about it. And this was, and it was either the Post and Courier or News and Courier article of June 15th, 1905. So, and I found this reading this in a book where they specifically referenced that article that was done on Jews in South Carolina. But the real one started that we know anything about in 1845 with Joseph and Charles Frank, Isaac and Marx Eisman were the first two around. They were traveling peddlers and they set up shop in Darlington. And a few years later, Heim and Henry Himes came, Samuel Marco and August Nachman. These were Jews of German descent. They opened stores in Darlington. This dated from the Darlington News, whatever they call the news and press back then, October 1st, 1856. This was Himes and Nachman. And in looking through some of the old stuff, you could find advertisements, and then sometimes they go to Europe for a while and come back and reopen their stores. In the 1860s, we had the unpleasantries from the north, and we had several Jews from Darlington serve in the Civil War. I. Newguest was killed at Gettysburg. The others, Isaac Abraham, S. Marco, M. Marco, and Heim Himes, also served in the army. But with all this going on, most of the Jews left. Joseph and Frank Eisman were the only ones that remained at the end of the war. However, Reconstruction happened, lots of movement in and out, and more came to town. In early politics, Heim Himes was the intendant, the mayor of Darlington in the 1850s before the Civil War. M. Marco was on the ballot in 1876, if you look right down here, for county commissioner. This, I believe, was a Democratic Party ballot for Darlington County. Some guy named Wade Hampton, you might have heard of him. There were all sorts of issues and a lot of politics back there. Aaron Baruch was the county sheriff. He was the guy, remember I said, was kind of thought to be corrupt. More Jews moved to Darlington. This is a picture of the west side of the Darlington Square in around 1880. Most of these guys were merchants. They opened stores, dry goods stores, occasional pharmacies and everything. This was Henry Hennig's store. It was on Pearl Street in Darlington, I believe. And it is, if you look down here, it's dated 1892. And I know the store burned in 1892. I'm not sure if this was the before or after because they rebuilt the store. David, do you know?
I don't know.
This, by the way, was David and my great-grandfather. By 1900, there were about 50 Jews in Darlington. They made up 1% of the population, but they were doing pretty well. The taxable property was about 20%, and a lot of them owned land. A lot of them came by the land. They were actually lien merchants, which they gave their merchandise out on credit, and sometimes things didn't happen the way that they ought to, and people would leave or move, and they would end up with the foreclosed land. The Darlington Hebrew Cemetery Association was formed in 1896, just a few years after the one in Florence. There were attempts at making a congregation a couple of times in the 1890s, but nothing really happened until in late 1905, the Darlington Hebrew Association was formed, and this is the state charters of eleemosynary corporations. And Henry Hennig, Isaac Lewenthal, and S. Wolfram petitioned the state of South Carolina, which granted them a charter on January 26, 1906, for the Darlington Hebrew Association. It was for religious and educational purposes. Interesting, a few months later, some of them petitioned for incorporation of something called the Darlington Hebrew Social Club, with Weinberg, Alexander, and D.D. Whitcover as the initial ones. So I'm not sure exactly what kind of social club it was. We'll hear more later on one of these guys. Rabbi Jacob Klein from Temple Sinai in Sumter, a very established congregation, came once a month to lead Reform services. In 1919, Rabbi Jacob Raisin from KKBE in Charleston became our community rabbi. He would come up to Darlington by train and conduct services in religious school one Sunday each month. This was predating him coming to Florence. In 1925, the Sisterhood, which had been the Ladies' Aid Society for years earlier, was officially formed, and they affiliated with the National Federation of Temple Sisterhoods. They and the Darlington Hebrew Association took over the functions of the Cemetery Association that had originally been formed. In 1954, they had the 30th convention of the South Carolina Federation of Temple Sisterhoods here in Darlington at the Masonic Hall. So even in a small town like Darlington, they were able to host the state convention. There were thoughts back in the 20s of building a synagogue. Efforts were made, but the Depression came along and halted the idea. The population had gotten up to around 85 persons, not families, but persons, in Darlington and the area surrounding the town. But after the 20s, with the Depression, it shrunk down to about 35, and so building a synagogue never happened. Rabbi Raisin passed away in 1946, and the religious activity in Darlington pretty much ceased for a few years. But in 1953, they reorganized as the Darlington Hebrew Congregation. Rabbi Aaron Levy of Sumter was hired to lead the services. And I can remember Rabbi Levy coming when I was a kid. He used to come over to Ms. Walt's house, and we'd hold services one Sunday afternoon every month.
That's who married us.
That's right. And thank you for helping arrange me to get the picture of him. He continued through late 60s. It was probably about 1968 or 69 when he stopped coming. There was a lot of community involvement in Darlington. Darlington Jews have served as president or in leadership roles of a lot of civic organizations over the years. They've been president of the Kiwanis Club. Four of the founding members of the Kiwanis Club in Darlington were Jewish. Lions Club, those of you that may remember Al Leff, was president of the Lions Club several different times. They were in the Chamber of Commerce. They served on boards on the Boy Scouts, the Historical Commission, Red Cross, Civil Defense, and even the Darlington Country Club, There were comments from somebody. We couldn't even get into the Florence Country Club. Herbert Hennig was the original secretary and treasurer of the Darlington Country Club when it was formed in 1926. There was definite assimilation in Darlington. They served in the Spanish-American War. I believe it was Henry Appelt, if you've seen his grave marker. In World War I, World War II, and the Korean War. Children went to public schools. Actually, St. John's High School was an Episcopal school, started in 1819. I graduated from St. John's, but it was a public school after the Civil War. And they kept the same name, and it's still present. The high school isn't, but the elementary school is. There were no private schools to send your kids to. Some played sports. This is the St. John's High football team. Anybody know Julian Hennig from Columbia?
Sure.
Yep. They graduated from high school. Hilda Hennig, class of 13, my grandmother. The kicker is we still have the dress. Some went to college and even postgraduate school. The congregation produced all sorts of different people, judges, physicians, attorneys, doctors of philosophy. David Whitcover was an alderman. He served for 30 years as the president of the State Fair Association. O.A. Alexander served three terms on city council, three terms as mayor. He was chairman of the Selective Service Appeal Board for a 17-county area in South Carolina. Abe Hyman, 25 years as a school board trustee, succeeded by his son Melvin Hyman. Herbert Hennig, city judge, 50 years. You did not want to be in his court if you'd done something wrong. Trust me. He was secretary of the Carolinas District of Kiwanis International for 35 years. Everybody in the Kiwanis Club across the country knew who he was. There were two doctors of philosophy. In Darlington, Robert Lumiansky. He was a scholar of medieval English. He was provost and dean of the graduate school at Tulane, then taught at Duke University, then was chairman of the Department of English at University of Pennsylvania, and finally professor of English at NYU, where he retired. He's a past president of Phi Beta Kappa, member of the National Selection Committee for the Woodrow Wilson Fellowship Corporation, and a member of the Council of the National Endowment for the Humanities from Darlington, South Carolina. It's amazing that high school not only produced him, but Hennig Cohen, another PhD in English, professor of American Literature at the University of Pennsylvania, and executive secretary of the American Studies Association. That's from a little town in Darlington, from a little high school. It probably didn't have more than two dozen students graduating. You get two doctors of philosophy and English in major universities. Sam Rogel. Sam attended law school at Duke University. One of his classmates was famous or infamous. His name was Richard Nixon. He went to law school at University of South Carolina, did real estate law. He's the most honest attorney I've ever known in my life, a most upstanding person. Samuel Wont, an attorney who on several occasions was appointed as a special circuit judge. Leroy Wont, an attorney in Darlington and a county court judge. His wife, Sadie Wont, was a correspondent for the state newspapers. So we had lots of people in Darlington that went on and did a lot of things. Now, some occasionally may have gotten into a little trouble. This is D.D. Whitcover, our David and my great-great uncle, who apparently, and I don't have the exact date, but this is special to the state newspaper, the constables kind of raided their establishment in Timmonsville and found a few empty kegs that smelt as if in times past they had been receptacles for something a little stronger than water. Had a little speakeasy. Now, from what I have heard, I never knew Uncle Dave because he died a few years before I was born, but Uncle Dave never married. He liked to smoke cigars. He liked to imbibe a little bit. He apparently liked to gamble and chase women, never got married. So some of them did get into a little trouble.
Alex, one of those woodcovers, the potentate of the shrine, I believe I've seen that on the shrine certificate.
I believe so.
One of the woodcovers over there was
the potentate.
Excuse me?
Scottish Rite, maybe.
Yes, D.D. Whitcover also, in all this carrying on, was actually president of the State Fair Association, which y'all in Columbia have been to the State Fair. He used to bring fireworks. The salesman sampled him fireworks, which he would bring back to Darlington, and, you know, New Year's and stuff. They always had great firework displays because he brought all this stuff home. Yes, I'm fairly sure that he was probably involved with the Masons. After the 60s, the congregation just dwindled to a handful of people. A lot of them, you know, when we were growing up, they joined the congregation here. Why? Because to send people to Sunday school here, he had to join the congregation. So a lot of the parents joined the Florence congregation, and Darlington's congregation became assimilated in. On May 5th, 1981, the sisterhood met for the last time and notified the National Federation of their dissolution. By June of 1981, they'd arranged perpetual care for the cemetery, and the funds of the congregation were placed in savings and the trustees appointed. There are only a couple of families now left in Darlington from what was the largest congregation in the area in the 1890s. Thank you.
Well, I know there's, and I'm not prepared to be able to provide a whole lot of detail, but I know there are two Darlington residents that he didn't mention that we are forever grateful for, and that is Alex and his wife, Diane, for everything they do. So 100 years from now, we'll have to make sure that your picture's in the presentation. How's that? Okay. Next. Mr. Harold Kornluth. I think everybody here knows Harold, so requires no introduction.
I am tangentially related to the Friedman family out of Holly Hill, Charleston, in that area, and that relationship comes through my mother's sister, Toby Lurie, who was married to Saul Lurie, whose mother was a Friedman from Holly Hill. And as the story goes, there were a number of sisters in that family that included the Levinson family, Libby Levinson, okay, and who was a Friedman, and Ann Lurie Simon, who was a Friedman, and there came a point where there was a brother who was living up north who had been involved with the Communist Party for whatever reason, and I take that to mean that there was a lot of Jewish individuals that were involved with the Communist Party in the 20s and the 30s because they were the only ones that were fighting fascism in Europe, and that was the outlet for fighting fascism. And Mr. Friedman, as the story goes, was a communist up there, and all of a sudden things got a little bit too hot for him up there. They started in the 40s, late 40s and early 50s, and they moved him down to the family said got him to move down south, and they ended up moving him to Pamplico, which is, if you don't know where Pamplico is, it's down on the river in Florence County, but it's way down in the corner, almost to Marion County, and it's quite out of the way. And now, My connection with Mr. Friedman is just to hear that story that was told to me by my Aunt Toby, who is still kicking along pretty good, and she mentioned that he was a little nebbishy guy, not to be too dramatic about him, but they lived in Pamplico, and the feds apparently came looking for him, and then I'm going to let Alex fill you in on what he knows about that, because Alex had family in Pamplico, and he can tell you what happened in Pamplico.
What actually went on, the Friedmans had been in town. Fannie Friedman actually founded the library in Pamplico. It's a little small town. I mean, they have a blinking light, okay? It's that small. Agricultural community, and if you can imagine back in the 1950s, there wasn't much going on there. But they were simple people, agricultural people. Fannie took people in. She taught several people to read. She'd give them books out of her library, and she actually founded the library in Pamplico. When the McCarthy communist seekers came looking for them, you know, the townspeople had really taken them under their wing and really liked them a lot. And, you know, they worried about communists in Russia, but to walk into Pamplico, South Carolina in the early 1950s and say, I'm from the government, they distrusted the government a lot more than they did the communists, particularly when they were looking for Morris Friedman. And it was like, who? We don't have anybody like that around here. And the townspeople actually hid him from the federal agents that were looking for this communist who was going to bring down the United States. Like Harold said, you know, he was a communist because back then when he joined the Communist Party, either you were for him or against him. If you weren't in the party, then you were probably going to get killed. But this story was related to me by my father many years ago. Was there a question? Okay. So that's pretty much the story on the Red Scare in Pamplico.
Thank you for that. The next story is Donna Cohen is going to share with us about her father and the fighter jet discovery.
For a lot of my youth, I had heard my father tell stories about the war, and his favorite story was finding a Messerschmitt 262 jet in the last days of the war. He was with his 107th Battalion, the Ozarks, kind of winding up, going through an area of Germany called Gardelegen, and he came upon a big warehouse and decided to check it out. And inside saw technology that the United States did not have, which was a German fighter jet. We did not have the jet technology. So having heard this story for a long time, Leonard asked me in 2008 for Veterans Day if he could tell this story to the newspaper. So thinking that at this stage of Leonard's life, some of this story might not be exactly accurate, I did some due diligence and contacted the Smithsonian, which is where he said that the jet had been placed. I spoke to folks at the Air and Science Museum. And yes, indeed, this was a jet that was recovered. It was flown to Le Havre, France, by ace pilots. It came over to the United States on a ship. It was housed by the Smithsonian Institute at one of their warehouses in Maryland for a couple of decades. And at some point when they revamped the Air and Space Museum, they added this jet to the collection. And it sits now today next to the Spirit of St. Louis. And I have a the newspaper article that we did with Leonard, and there's a picture that I got from the Smithsonian of the actual jet, and you can see it has swastikas all over it. So when they put it in the museum, they painted over the swastikas and did a cloud scene so that it's blue and white clouds painted all over the jet. So this is the story of Leonard and the Messerschmitt. I also have on the table Leonard's bronze star and some of his medals from when he was in service. Leonard was a young gentleman who grew up in Latta and never went hunting or fishing or any of those kinds of things, but yet he received marksmanship awards and medals and things when he was in service. At the end of the war, Leonard was attached to the G2 Intelligence Division because he spoke fluent Yiddish. So the displaced persons that needed to go back to Poland and wherever they were from originally that had been brought to other areas, Leonard was one of the people who assisted in communicating with these people to try and get them back to their homelands. So on the table you can see his medals, and in 2007, Leonard went on one of the honor flights, which is when we have wonderful people in the state who have donated funds so that veterans can go to the veterans' memorials in Washington. And these World War II veterans, excuse me, as you might guess, are many very incapacitated. And so they have volunteer military folks who go on the plane with them to assist them. It's a one-day trip up and back, and it was a great highlight of his life as well to be able to go on that trip. And the hat that says World War II veteran was given to him on that trip. Yes, ma'am. Leonard was my father.
Oh, thank you.
Okay. I'm sorry. I assumed everybody knows Leonard. Leonard and my mother were pretty close to lifelong members of this congregation, but were also members of Shalom when we were younger children in Dillon. Any questions? Okay. Thank you.
Donna, thank you very much for that. Okay, we're doing really, really well on time here, so moving along. Dr. Phil Greenberg is going to share with us some memories of growing up Jewish in the PD area. As I understand, his brother Stuart has documented a lot of these memories in a memoir, and I think he's going to reference some of that in his discussion. So, without further ado.
Unfortunately, I left his memoir somewhere and I couldn't find it. But I'd like to just talk about growing up as a baby boomer in Florence. My parents, as you know, moved back from other places in the late 1940s. I was born in 1948. My brother was born in 1949. And I'd sort of like to flesh out some of the things that the other speakers have talked about as far as the number of Jewish families that moved into Florence back in the late 40s, early 50s, and what an impact they made on the city, the temple, and the area. And some of them have been mentioned. I think the Siegels mentioned the light bulb plant. The Levies have talked about heritage sportswear. We had the Siegel family, another Siegel family, Arthur and Ethel, moved to Florence in the early 1950s, and they started a company called Burrow Wood, or they moved a company from New York that manufactured cabinets for apartments and houses, and they at one time employed up to 500 people in Bennettsville. They lived in Florence but commuted to Bennettsville every day, and they were, you know, participants in various community organizations such as the Rotary Club and the Masonic Temple and the Shriners Club. Wentworth Manufacturing Company was probably the largest employer influence from 1952 through 1966. And I remember as a child or as a teenager in 1963, my mother, as you heard about, that was a very strong individual, said, "You've got to get a job this summer. You can't just lay around and do nothing." So every morning at 5 o'clock, Steve Glass, who's another Jewish man who was an attorney here who's now moved away, would get up and we would be taken to Lake City. And at that time, Wentworth Manufacturing employed 1,200 people, which manufactured ladies, I think they were called house coats. And at that time, most women stayed home during the day. They didn't work. And they had contracts with JCPenney, Sears, all of the big national retail companies. And they manufactured thousands and thousands of these ladies' dresses and ladies.
They did the Molly Goldberg.
Molly Goldberg was the name of their line.
They renamed it to Molly Goldberg.
Right.
The dresses of the
S-year. They made all the... After World War II, in the early part of the 50s, Florence and the South Carolina area was the China of that period, because all of these companies moved from the Northeast where the labor was very expensive. And as Pat was telling me, she hired mostly black people and taught them how to make these cabinets and drive the trucks to deliver the cabinets. So they worked for maybe half the wages of what they would pay in New York here. And so, and also the same was in Wentworth. And Wentworth at one time had the large manufacturing facility in Lake City, which is 20 miles south of here on Highway 52. They had a large plant here in Florence. On the Sopkins was the family that had that. They built another plant here, and it was on Sopkin Avenue. Now, Ronald Sopkin, no one has mentioned him. He was probably one of the most community organizers or community-minded people in Florence. That when I was a young person, he founded the Bank of Florence. He was on the airport commission and started, you know, the jet flights from Washington, on at that time Eastern Airlines, Washington and Atlanta. He and his wife Doris, instrumental in starting the community concert series. They founded the Little Theater, which is now a beautiful building on Dargan Street. They also were big in the Democratic Party. They had many events at their home where they hosted Bill Clinton. They hosted every Democratic president. Jimmy Carter came to Florence, went straight to their house. He even spent the night there. So, I mean, I'm not going to advocate their political feelings, but at least they were very prominent in Democratic circles. Another family that really was not a part of Beth Israel but did come was the Green family from Clio, South Carolina. They had the big-time dog food company, Marmot Packages, that made all of the dog food in this area, or in the whole country, I think. They manufactured canned goods up until the late 60s, and they're no longer here.
They also were the first people that did the
Oh, they made the sea rations for the packaging for... I didn't know that. That was before my time. Right. Right. But just to kind of flesh out, you know, the retail, they had a lot of other retailers in Florence itself. They had Stein's Men's Shop. They had Gladstone's Dress Shop. They had Neiman's Jewelry Store. And many other retailers. They also had Larry's on Dargan Street, and they had a couple of other Jewish merchants. So Florence was the center. Even though the people did not have their factories in Florence, they lived in Florence. They were members of Beth Israel, and they contributed to the life of the Jewish community. Another thing I'd like to flesh out is, and this is extremely interesting, one of the early rabbis here was a fellow by the name of Morris Clark. I don't know if you remember him yesterday when they were showing pictures. The first one that I can remember was Rabbi Fabian, then Morris Clark. He came in the early 1950s when I was 4 years old, so I don't really remember him. But about a year ago, a friend of mine who's a doctor in Charleston, who was the dean of the medical university by the name of Leighton McCurdy, grew up in Florence. He was a senior in high school in 1952, and Rabbi Clark, for some reason, lived next door to his parents. and he became very enamored with Rabbi Clark. And Rabbi Clark's wife had just died, and he was from New York and never knew how to drive a car. So he came to Layton and said, "Layton, I'm going to go to Mexico for the summer, but I need a driver. I have a car. I want you to drive me from Florence to Mexico City, and I'll pay for you to come back." And so Layton McCurdy, I don't know if any of you people from Charleston know him, a very, very smart guy, said as he went to Mexico, they stopped in all these places. And apparently Rabbi Clark was very, I won't say communist-leaning, but he had a lot of friends who were involved in the in that endeavor. And he met a lot of these people. He met some artists. One was a Spanish artist that did a mural in Washington that was extremely... Diego Rivera was his friend. And he stayed with him, and he stayed with some people that were friends of his in Mexico. And he just was asking me if I knew him. Of course, I was 4 years old at the time. I didn't know him, but that was just interesting to know that our rabbi was had. And then he eventually retired down in Mexico, I think in Guadalajara, after he left Florence, which is an interesting story. So one thing about the Wentworth Manufacturing Company, Steve Glass and I, we would go down there every day, and we'd look around, and there would be like 800 cars in the parking lot. And one day I said, "Steve, you know what? The Sopkins bought all these cars because they're hiring all these people, and they are responsible for the economy of the area." So I thought that was real interesting. So that's just a few little.
Thank you very much. Anybody have any questions or comments at this point? Anything they want to share? Okay. Moving on, our next presenter is our very own, our most senior member of the congregation. She is 94 years young, and her name is Miss Gert Radin. And we are excited to have her today, and she's going to talk to us about a Southern gefilte fish story, which, as I understand, is a reflection of some of the sacrifices you have to make when you're a small fish trying to grow up in the big pond of the South.
I say it's not really a long story, but it was a ritual in my home on Friday night to have gefilte fish, soup and luction, and baked chicken. But when we came here, the mama couldn't buy the regular fish, so she bought catfish and made gefilte fish out of catfish. And that's something we will never forget, because nobody would believe that it turned out as good as it did.
All right. Mort Bernanke is going to come up and join us, and he is going to talk to us. As you know, Mort's from the Dillon area, the Dillon congregation, as is his nephew, Ben Bernanke, and I think he's going to elaborate on that a little bit.
No, I'm not. No,
you're not. Well, you have the mic now, so.
Well, nobody told me what to talk about, so I'll talk about me. Well, actually, I will mention something about Ben. Everybody knows about it. Just a short little story about it. 3 weeks ago, I got a telephone. I've had a lot of people call me from the very beginning of Ben's chairmanship. I had them from the Atlanta Journal, from the New York Times, from television stations, from Miami Herald. And finally, I said, "What do you want from me?" I said, "Well, you're the only Jew, or the only Bernanke left in Dillon, so we want to know about Ben's early childhood." So it's been in all the magazines, so we'll get to that maybe later, or just let it go. But everybody knows how wonderful he is, and he's just amazing. He really is. He's not politically motivated. He believes in starting something, and he hopes to be able to finish it. He's going to be in his eighth year next year, which is as many years as a president spends. And when we saw him recently at my poor brother's funeral, couple of months ago. That was his father. We asked him, "Son, are you going to, if they ask you to do it again, would you do it?" And before he could answer, his wife spoke up, Anna, and she says, "Over my dead body," she said. She's had enough. Anyway, Harold, I thought he was going to tell more about the Ohav Shalom, because his parents go back further than I do. We're just newcomers. We came there in 1941, if that's new enough, okay? My mother and my father. Okay, quickly. My father was from Austria-Poland area, and believe it or not, as a Jewish person, he was a lieutenant in the Austrian army. You believe that? He was wounded a little bit, and they sent him to Siberia. But being an officer, the articles of war were in effect then, and they treated them with sort of respect, I guess. And he was able to go into the little town in the middle of nowhere. At the end of the war, the Japanese, I think, came over and took over the camps. And they were worse than the Russians. So my father went into town. He was befriended. There was a Jewish family there or something. And he got on a train and he went to China, Shanghai, China, right from Siberia, right on down. And he was taken in by some Jewish manufacturers. So I asked our Rabbi Jeff Ronald a couple of months ago before he left, I said, "Were there Jews in China?" He said, "Oh, yes, there were a lot of Jews in China," which I did not know. So meanwhile, my mother was in medical school at the University of Vienna. Back then, women were mostly housewives and using scrubbing boards and cleaning clothes, but my grandfather, who had never been at school a day in his life, was very modern. He wanted all his girls to be professionals. So my mother went to the University of Vienna. And for some reason, I don't know why, in 1920, they immigrated to the United States. They didn't have any money, so he borrowed $1,000 from some of the relatives. And he went to Fordham University and studied pharmacy. My mother practiced medicine and raised three boys. So, but she never really particularly liked New York. She wanted to live in the South. Of course, she had experience working years ago, before I was born, in Wilmington, North Carolina. Dr. Bullock from there had an advertisement for a physician to come down and take care of us. Like, it was a hospital pretty much like Elliot Finger had in Marion. He had about 15 beds, you know, and he had a little infirmary. So my mother came down, and she loved it. She took care of the patients. She supervised the cooking. She did the shopping. She did. But meanwhile, my older brother Fred got a mastoid, which you don't really see much anymore because of the antibiotics that we have. And she felt guilty and she came home. So we stayed there for 20 years. And we have relatives in Lake City, the Haydens. My middle name is Hayden, by the way. And they had a pharmacy. So we came down, we visited, and in 1941, my father moved down here and moved me and my brother Philip, at 13 years old, to come down from New York to come down to South Carolina. It's like coming to a different country. But I survived, and I went to the University of South Carolina and studied pharmacy, came back. My father, meanwhile, you know, it was depression before that, but in the war years, people made money because, you know, it was war years. So 50, I came back and I went into the pharmacy with my father. A few years later, Philip came back. By the way, Philip he never studied pharmacy. He had a master's degree in theater arts. As a matter of fact, Larry, he was the first professional director that Florence Little Theater ever had, really. And he and Edna, his wife, moved to Augusta after a while. There was an old operating room theater there, and he had a theater in the round. But he couldn't make enough money because, you know, he was supporting, Ben was born there, and so I said to him, "Philip, why don't you come back to Dillon?" And we managed to get him a license to practice from. You know, when you're born into this thing, you just seem to know a lot about something. And So we got him a license. He and I practiced pharmacy with my father till 1961 when we said, Pop, why don't you retire and we'll buy the business from you. So we did. And in 1971, we decided if we're going to work this hard, we need to have a nice, this was Main Street, having a store on Main Street. We're going to build a building, and we went off Main. And my father was, just before he died, he says, you can't do that. I said, why not? He says, because you can't leave Main Street in the small towns. Main Street was it, you know. We said, we don't care. So we bought a piece of property one block behind the old drugstore. We built a pretty large pharmacy, and we had about 24 parking spaces, which then was becoming very important. Well, we went there, we operated that, and finally in 1996, we sold the business. And Philip retired, moved to Charlotte, because Edna, his wife, was from Charlotte. And I told my wife, Rita, I said, you know, I don't want to retire. And I remember Alan Schaefer, you talked about Alan Schaefer yesterday. Alan Schaefer called me. He did everything in a big way. Whenever he wanted anything from the drugstore, he wouldn't send just a little note. It would be on a piece of paper in large letters. This is the way he was. This is the way he lived, kind of man he was. He said, Mort, you should not retire. He said, because he worked until he was in his late 80s. I said, well, I thought about it. And I said to my wife, Rita, said, well, maybe we can do something else. So when you sell a business, you have a contract that says you cannot operate. You can't do anything in competition. The Rite Aid was people that bought. They were a Jewish outfit, by the way. At that time, they were the largest in the world before they got into trouble. Largest in the country, rather. And so she said, well, we got a little building across the street. We'll remodel it for you. And I opened up a... we had already done some of this in the pharmacy. Medical equipment, wheelchairs, oxygen. We taught people how to use the diabetic testing. They were coming into vogue back then. Now everybody tests for diabetes. Then they didn't know much about it, but we got that started. And I took a couple of my employees with me, and we stayed there. I said, we'll stay there 2 years. Stayed 13. I was 79 when I retired 3 years ago. Anyway, so it was. I want to tell you also about Harold. You didn't mention that, but our synagogue, Ohav Shalom. We had a beautiful building, and we had a social hall like this. We had parties that were so great that people from Florence came over to us, primarily because we had. You mentioned Marnat Packing Company. Not a lot of people know this, but Eddie Green, very good friends of Pat. They also had Borough Woods in Bennettsville. They had the Borough Woods, which they were not involved with us because you all moved over to Florence. But they had a big operation there, 500 people. Well, also in the same town, Eddie Green from Philadelphia. A lot of you probably know Eddie. He was a marvelous person. And they opened up a dog food factory. And with him, he brought Arthur Rehm, who's a member of our congregation. We celebrated his 93rd birthday at Myrtle Beach a couple of weeks ago. He was one of the managers, and also Leonard Fields, who was a cousin. They were all related. Well, among them, they had, how many kids did they have, Pat? They had nine kids. Okay, so they all came to Dillon. They belonged to Ohav Shalom. We had a pretty good Sunday school.
The Clio Crowd.
And boy, could they put on a party. I'm not kidding you. They really were very active, wonderful, wonderful people. Eddie was such a gourmet cook that he has a plaque up in Clemson somewhere in there celebrating all the things that he has done for them. And anyway, so we had a good Sunday school there. I taught Hebrew there after Reuben Goldman died. And we bar mitzvahed and bat mitzvahed every one of our 20, 25 kids, every one of them. And we had help from Florence, thank goodness. We had the rabbi would come on Sundays and whenever he possibly could. We had a little lecture series with him. And so that's what I know about that. And in 86, I think it was, we we sold the building. I had an argument with one of these. You don't know him. He's not here. But he said he didn't want to leave the synagogue. I said, we only have three families. I said, this is what good is an empty building? It's the people that go in the building. So P.S., we closed the building. We didn't sell it. Harold's father, Moses, was very instrumental. He's the one that took care of it. He sold it about 7 or 8 years later. And we all came over here and joined over here in 86. My wife had the idea that, what do you do with the money? We had $80,000, $85,000. And she said, to prevent arguments, let everybody have one vote. Not husband and wife together, because they may argue and you'd have a problem. So we had one vote, and you can give it anywhere you want to give it, but you had to give it to a Jewish cause. And well, most of the people gave the money over here. We did. And they told us that we didn't have to pay dues after that, but we've always paid dues. We just disregarded that. And it's been a wonderful association over here. Really, this
foundation
is a
foundation really appreciated.
Huh?
Our foundation really appreciated it. It really gave our foundation
Anyway, so
Mortimer, don't forget to tell a little bit about Ben and the spelling bee.
Oh yeah, yeah. If you got a minute, I'll tell you a little bit about something about my nephew Ben. First, about our kids, about our drugstore in the state of South Carolina. I was trying to figure out how many Jewish pharmacies were there. The one in Charleston.
My father had one in Somerton.
Somerton? You can count them on the fingers of your hand, really.
There were several.
Yeah, it was Koenig here, yeah, and there was a
Abbeville.
Yeah, Koenig, yeah, but my father used to associate with your father.
There were several in Charleston.
I know. But now I don't think, with the advent of the big chains, there's nobody practically.
Abbeville had one.
But the kind of service that we gave was, my brother Philip was very altruistic, Ben's father. And he said, we've got to give people the service. Nobody talked to anybody. We've got to talk to the people. And there's a lot of psychology in medicine. And you got to talk to them. Every new prescription that went out, you have to go out. Then we told our other pharmacists, you got to go out. You got to say something positive to that patient. And teach them some of this stuff was complicated, how to use it. We were dealing with semi-literate people. We had a great following. My brother Philip got interested in herbal medicine and homeopathic medicine. And I said, homeopathic medicine? And it turned out, the darn stuff, there's a big history in that. There's even a homeopathic medical school up in Philadelphia, I think. And the stuff worked. I mean, we've seen it. Anyway, that's besides the point. We gave a lot of service to people. And the whole town always called Philip, Dr. Phil, and he was a marvelous person. He gave people so much time. I said, a half an hour you spend with somebody? 45 minutes? But anyway, and we felt that was very important. I'm afraid that even though the young pharmacists, they are very well educated. They got 6 years of school. They come out with a doctor of pharmacy. They know a lot of stuff. They really do know a lot of stuff. There are 4,000 or 5,000 drugs they got to know about, and their interactions and their side effects and everything. But they're not given the chance because of the commercialism. They're not given a chance to convey their knowledge to the public. Well, anyway, I came back, and then we retired. But let me tell you about the children quickly. I had two children, Mindy and Mark. Mindy got her master's degree in University of Georgia in speech pathology. She has a large office in Atlanta. She deals more. She deals in occupational therapy. She knows a lot about autism. She's got a nice practice there. My son Mark was based in Charlotte, and then they moved him to Philadelphia. He's with a big computer company. He manages 17 or 18 states, I think. He's doing well. Phyllis family, well, Ben, okay. The problem was Ben was the oldest of the five, my two kids and Philip's three kids, okay? So he was first in school. Some of the stuff that it was in, I don't think it was really accurate. When he got into first grade, the teacher said, I can't handle this kid. We'll send him to the second grade. So he went, that was all throughout the whole, his whole history. When he was in high school, when he was in I guess you'd call it middle school, he won the South Carolina Spelling Bee. Somebody said he didn't. I know he won the South Carolina, he was champion South Carolina Spelling. Then he went to Washington. And he came in second in Washington. And the reason for that was, he said, you know, they asked him to spell, what was the name of that? They asked him to spell Edelweiss. He never heard of that. His parents hadn't taken him to see The Sound of Music yet, so he didn't. So he missed it, so he came in second. And from there, he went to Harvard, and first in Harvard, and he went to MIT, and then he went to Stanford as a professor, and then they got him into Princeton. He became chairman of the economic department, and then President Bush called him up, and he made a lot of speeches. He was on the board, Federal Reserve Board, too. But Bush called him up to be chairman of his economic council. And from that, after Greenspan, which, by the way, Pat's maiden name is Greenspan, she must be related to him somewhere. So anyway, so he went to the Federal Reserve Board. And I told this story before, but I'm going to tell you again. His mother, Edna, she was a worrier. She worried, saying, what is he going to wear? He's a professor. He doesn't know how to dress, you know. He wears leather sleeves on his jackets. He gets on television.
When he decided to go to Harvard, Edna was afraid he wasn't
going to
be dressed
well. Yeah, okay, so I asked him at one of our bar mitzvah affairs, I said, Ben, where are you getting your clothes? You got awfully nice suits. They look nice on you. They said, Joseph Bank. I said, well, you better buy them on sale. You better don't pay full price over there. So anyway, so it was difficult for my kids and his siblings to follow him. They all did well. They did okay, but they were not up to his par, of course, because he was really like a genius. He taught calculus in high school. They didn't give that, and somebody wanted to know about calculus. He started teaching him calculus. He tutored some kids. But they all my kids worked in the pharmacy. They all did in high school, every one of them. But Ben also did work at South of the Border. He went out to be a waiter. And Arthur Remus said, who had experience when, you know, remember Arthur, he was good friends with us. He's from the Clio crowd. And when he was in Michigan, he said he learned how to get tips, you know. He said, he gave Ben some tips on how to get tips, you know, as he's waiting. Then also we were building the new hospital there, and Ben decided he needed to build himself up, so he started hauling cement, and bricks, and mortar and everything. Okay, so then he went on, and our kids went on, and that's about it. I can't think of anything else. I told you about my parents. Okay. When my mother was a physician, when we came to South Carolina, it was very traumatic for her. She was such a good diagnostician. It was wartime, and the doctors were gone into the service. There was really nobody around, so that's why we did a lot of helping a lot of people. She wanted to reciprocate her medical license from the state of New York, where she practiced for 20 years, but South Carolina didn't like to reciprocate with northern states because they said, well, we got better schools than you do. So she went to Marion, where the head of the medical board was, and she said, I'd like to reciprocate. He says, first he told her, in so many words, he said, why don't you go on home? But anyway, she said, I want to take the state board. And it's been 20 years since I took one, but if I pass it, give me my license so I can help the people in Dillon. If not, don't give it to me. He said, you're a graduate of a foreign school. You got to go back to medical school for another couple of years and get a degree in the United States. So I can't do that. My husband just started a new business. I have two sons to raise. My older brother was already in Air Force. And so that was that. So she was very traumatic. I think she went through a deep state of depression because of that. But she went in a drugstore, helped my father, and helped a lot of people, whatever she could there. And that's our story.
You didn't say that all of your other sisters were pharmacists also.
Who? Oh, yeah. We were a whole bunch of my mother had three sisters, and my grandfather told them in Europe, said, you got to do something professional. So they all my aunts were pharmacists. My father was a pharmacist. I am, my brother, my older brother. I guess there are other ones around, too. Okay.
One of them in Darlington, one
that was Aunt Jean. Yeah, that was one of my aunts.
Her house one time.
Yeah, that was my aunt. She's a wonderful, wonderful lady, my favorite aunt. Thank you. This was a wonderful, wonderful affair. And I want to thank Matt and Alex and Diane and everybody else involved and our actor over here. You want to go to the little theater and see the play, The Foreigner. That's why he wasn't here last night. He's one of the stars. When I was younger, I got so bored in Dillon after I came back in 1950, and I had done some theatrical work in University of South Carolina. So a friend of mine who was from Brooklyn, he was down there, he had done theater work. Said, let's start a little theater. So we started one. We built our own sets in a tobacco barn somewhere, and we had a little theater that we put on about 4 years. We put on about 16 plays, really did. It kept me alive there, anyway. But anyway, Dillon was good to us, and they still remember us to this day. To this day, they remember my brother. I go into Food Lion or I go to Walmart, and somebody always stops me and says how they appreciate it, even back to my father's days. So anyway, I thank you very much, and that's it. Matt, we got a good president here.
Can we step down this side? So on many of Friday nights after services at the O'Neg, I really enjoy standing around and talking to Mort and hearing his stories, and now you know why, because he is a wealth of knowledge and just all kinds of information to share. So thank you very much. Diane, if you'll join me up here. I believe Diane's got some things she wants to speak about.
Good morning. I would like to say that I am so grateful for all the Jews that decided to settle in this area. I understand a lot better how, you know, this congregation has come to be what we're really made of. So thank you to all you folks that have been here for that, and also to those people that aren't here today that came. So it's very broadening for me. Judy Kammer, unfortunately, is not here, but yesterday, when she was here, she and I were talking to Mike Krupsaw from Anderson, and he was saying, everything is very attractive when in our conversation. And it was so striking, because every time we would refer to this, our social hall, for really not just months but years, it would not be in those terms. So this is all very, very new, and because we were having this event, it gave us the push. We were going to, you know, make some improvements, not every single thing we wanted to do, but some major improvements. And Judy, unfortunately, she can put it best, but, you know, she had described to Mike that we have a group of young men that have done an amazing job to put all this together and put so much work into it, you know, elbow grease into all these improvements. And as she also said, we have a congregant whose brother is an architect, a big-time architect, who came and gave us a little consult. And that is Harvey Cohen. And Donna, our member who we heard from this morning, is a professional stager and also used some shoe leather to help make this happen, picking out what shade on the walls. This is a special finish on the walls. It's, believe me, a different animal. Working on all the contracts and the, you know, getting the price right and making sure we needed to have done what needed to be done, and also having a strong background in lighting fixture business. Donna helped us, along with the Supreme Lighting folks, or what they are today, which is...
Illy.
Well, Chris is SATCO, but yeah. we got some pictures from Elite, which is
Elite.
The family, which is the other end of the family business, but Chris works for SATCO, which is out of New York.
Okay. Adam's brother, Chris, helped us with these, so it has that connection to the lighting background. So Donna kind of made sure we painted certain things, certain colors, and in looking at some of these slides and seeing this paneling brown and thinking, yeah, Donna said, yes, you're not going to leave that brown. You're going to paint it to coordinate. These are not going to stay brown. They're going to be white. Anyway, the overall effect, I think, is fabulous. And I think we just want to tell them what a difference it's made. Thank you so much for the incredible amount of work you all have done. And we're really enjoying it. There is a member of the Jewish Historical Society that I would like to recognize, and that is Rachel Barnett, the president of the Jewish Historical Society, who has worked with us, the local committee, to put this this event together. She's sat on some kind of lengthy conference calls and giving us advice and weighing in on things, did a lot of coordinating of how things should fit together, piece together, and we were very grateful for everything that you did. Rachel, thank you. I have been personally impressed, I don't know about you, with the audiovisual, the AV as they call it, services that we've had during this meeting. And the guys are concerned about the mic problem that we had. I'm like, we did not have a mic problem, and you were right there. You know, I mean, a mic problem is when you can't straighten it out. They had things straightened out pretty quickly, and I mean, I didn't have any trouble hearing anybody. So that's how good it went. Everything went so smoothly. Larry Falk is a professional and our communications chair, and he's an AV professional to the hilt. And Matt Rich, constantly amazing me with the technology, the way he uses things and how quickly he does them. And, you know, I wouldn't even ask him to teach me, but, you know, way beyond. He put this incredible slideshow together. I've heard a lot of comments from people that they enjoyed seeing those slides. I know when I was listening to the letters, the rabbi letters, and he had the picture up with the rabbi, you know, how much that added. So that slideshow was a huge contribution, and we thank Larry and Matt so much for those contributions. And there's another group that I think has maybe more responsibility for the success of this weekend than any of us. And Vern, where's your gang at? Yeah, we wanted to see if Dorothy and Chardé could come out. Are they? Okay, we're waiting for you right now. I will just say that several of us in the planning were not so certain about how things were going to flow because we're using this, you know, one facility for everything. The meals are here, the sessions are here, and, you know, we know how crazy that can be. So somehow it did fit together. I've got to witness how these people work pretty closely during these last couple of days. And I have not seen people work harder or just work better. And I haven't seen people be as diligent and conscientious about doing a great job. And I tell you, we are extremely grateful for all you've done. And Bobby, who was here last night, the other member of the team, as well. Thank you again. Thank you. Okay, we're going to hear now from Matt.
Well, I think that... that wraps up our programming for this morning.